Jack Muir goes into heroism and investigates the humor of the subject with the help of Alfred Marx.
The Lone Ranger and Tonto were riding through the prairie one day when they heard the sound of thundering hooves. It was the Cheyenne Indians dressed in full war paint and looking very mean. Well, our two heroes galloped onward, but soon they saw another band of Cheyenne on the ridge in front of them. The Lone Ranger reined in his horse, turned to his trusty companion and said, "Well, Tonto, looks as if we're going to have to shoot it out." Tonto looked at him and said, "What do you mean, we, paleface?"
Excuse me, sir, there's a hero outside.
Who is it?
The Invisible Man.
Tell him I can't see him. An infantry regiment were in the thick of battle during the First World War. The sergeant ran into his young platoon commander. "Sir! Sir! We've run out of ammunition, sir!" "I say, run out of ammunition, have we? Oh, now then, mustn't let the enemy know. Mustn't let the enemy know. We've run out of ammunition. Now, whatever you do, keep firing." A big game hunter left his tent in the jungle one day without his gun and was confronted by an enormous lion preparing to spring. He froze. The animal leapt into the air, shot right over his head and landed beyond him. Well, the hunter turned around to see the animal poised for another jump. Again, it overshot the mark and landed beyond him. This continued. Eventually, the hunter was able to crawl back into his tent. As he emerged with his gun, he was amazed to see the lion on the other side of the clearing practicing little low jumps. During the desert campaign in the last war, it was rumored in the western desert that General Rommel was in the vicinity, and they wanted one man to volunteer to capture Rommel. It was a one-man effort. They couldn't send out a troop because they'd be seen, just one man. Private Smith volunteered. "I'll get Rommel, sir. I'll fetch him and bring him back, sir. All I want is a camel, radio, and supplies." And the officer said, "Right, very good." They gave him a camel, radio, and supplies, and off he went. A week later, they received a signal from him. Rommel captured. Well, the news spread around the world like wildfire. The whole of the West was jubilant. They waited for Smith to come back. 1 month, 2 months, no sign of Smith. Eventually, a lone figure in the desert, walking towards the camp. No camel, no supplies, no radio, nothing. The CO says, "Where is he?" He says, "Where's who?" He says, "Rommel." He says, "What do you mean?" He says, "There's your signal. Rommel captured." He says, "Oh, no, sir, that should have read camel ruptured."
It seems we all need heroes. Whether we're primitive tribesmen hearing the annals of great warriors of the past, or Liverpool football supporters hearing the sports report, we want someone to look up to. And he can come from any walk of life, said Thomas Carlyle.
The hero can be poet, prophet, king, priest, or what you will, according to the kind of world he finds himself born into.
The important thing about a hero is that he's someone whose exploits we can admire and imitate, but never quite equal. As soon as we're as good as he is, we have to look for another hero. Some authorities believe that anyone is capable of heroism. Matthew Arnold thought sheer willpower made it possible.
"The will is free, strong is the soul, and wise and beautiful. The seeds of godlike power are in us still. Gods we are, bards, saints, heroes, if we will."
"And we will."
"We will."
"Alfred, we will."
"You speak for yourself."
Lord Chesterfield, on the other hand, had a more pragmatic view of the subject.
"I'm convinced that a light supper, a good night's sleep, and a fine morning have sometimes made a hero of the same man who, by an indigestion, a restless night, and raining morning, would have proved a coward."
This rather cynical view of the claims of heroism is becoming increasingly prevalent, and there are many people who believe that heroes can't exist in a modern world of computers and cornflakes. And at times, modern heroism is difficult to imagine, particularly for oneself. George Moore.
"Nothing is more depressing than the conviction that one is not a hero."
I haven't had that trouble, but I can imagine it. Yeah. Part of the trouble in finding modern heroes is that war has been discredited as an honourable pastime, and military glory was an important part of an old-fashioned hero's makeup. The old-fashioned concept of the hero all too often involved dying an heroic death, which was, to say the least, inconvenient and made it difficult for heroism to become a growth industry. Sometimes death devalued the hero. Finlay Peter Dunne.
No man is a hero to his undertaker.
Oscar Wilde.
A thing is not necessarily true because a man dies for it.
Of course, one of the most heroic and pointless ways of dying is in a duel. Here's Mark Twain.
Much as the modern French duel is ridiculed by certain smart persons, it is in reality one of the most dangerous institutions of our day. Since it is nearly always fought in the open air, the contestants are nearly sure to catch cold.
Particularly at dawn. Let's hear an heroic, also an very brief, death scene from Sheridan's burlesque play, The Critic. Don Whisker Randolph, the hero, is dying, watched by a beef-eater. I thought I might play the part of the hero, Alfred.
I see.
Don Whisker Randolph.
Very good.
And you stand by as the beef-eater.
Which isn't easy for a vegetarian.
Are you quite ready?
Absolument.
Go. And Whisker Randolph quits this bustling scene for all eater.
Nitty, he would have added, but stern death cut short his being and the noun at once.
Sheridan was a little ahead of his time in pointing up the ridiculousness of heroic death in the theatre. He also gave a clue in the same play for how to recognise a heroine.
Oh, Lord, sir, when a heroine goes mad, she always goes into white satin.
It's a useful tip, that, because the problem of recognising heroic qualities is getting greater. There's another clue from Charles Churchill, writing of a rather small 18th century actor.
He's of stature somewhat low. Your hero always should be tall, you know.
And here's another thought from Dr. Johnson.
Claret is the liquor for boys, port for men, but he who aspires to be a hero must drink brandy.
Right, so we're getting to know what a hero looks like. Tall, drinks brandy, and if female, goes mad in white satin. Not an entirely satisfactory description, just a sort of rough guideline, really. Fortunately, some heroes are more readily identified. I mean, take Superman. Now, you might not recognize Clark Kent, the mild-mannered reporter, but you couldn't fail to recognize him when he changes into that suit.
Hello, hello. Yes, yes, this is Clark Kent. The mild-mannered reporter, yes. You're holding Lois Lane, and unless we come up with $1 million by tonight, we'll never see her again. She suggested I contact a Mr. S. Yes, I know what she means. Could I put you on hold for just a minute? I have a bit of a problem. Hello, B&W Cleaners. Look, this is Clark Kent, and the mild-mannered reporter, yes. I'm fine, thank you. Listen, there's been a mix-up on my suits, and I need it. I have to go out on a job right now. I'm sure it's not my suit. I brought it in this morning on one day service. Let me describe my suit to you. The cape is kind of a royal blue with white piping. And the leotards are kind of an off blue. No, they're not my wife's, no. They're mine. I'm not married. What's that supposed to mean? Look, maybe this will help you. On the jersey, there's a kind of red S. S for Clark Kent, yes. With an outfit like that, you wouldn't use your right initials either. Look, how would you like somebody to leap over tall buildings in a single bound and land right on your store? This is very difficult to explain. See, I sometimes fly in that suit. What do you mean, you bet I do? Why, if you can't find it, you might tide me over with some toreadors and a blouse. How'd you like somebody to come down there and knock that silly cigar out of your mouth? Never mind how I can see it. I can see it. Look, you can't find the suit. Is that it? All right, I have someone on hold. All right. Hello, kidnappers? Could I speak with Lois, please? Lois, baby? Listen, I don't think we're going to be able to get you out of this one, Lois.
Bob Newhart. It's sort of super mouse. One thing that every would-be hero must do to qualify is an heroic deed. But what is heroic now? It was easy enough in the days of actual military engagements, fighting on in spite of adversity, as in a verse from Chevy Chase, a 16th century poem by Richard Cheel.
For Witrington needs must I wail as one in doleful dumps, for when his legs were smitten off, he fought upon his stumps.
Well, that's a heroic feat. Another example is from an old edition of the Daily Mail.
Special praise to Petty Officer H. Robinson, gunnery instructor, who, when the guns jammed at one point, took out his false teeth and threw them towards the communists with an appropriate insult.
Battle of the River Plate, I think. Recently, new forms of heroism have crept into military life. Report from the Evening News.
To win a bet, a soldier at Hadlow, Kent, fried a pair of clean woolen socks in a public house and ate them.
Take courage. But even if it's difficult to recognize a modern hero, there's still a great deal written and spoken about former heroes. There are endless biographies and memoirs in the color supplements, and each great hero seems to engender an industry of assessment and reassessment.
T.E. Lawrence, the man and the myth. Which is man and which is myth? Is this fact or is it lies? What is truth and what is fable? Where is Ruth and where is Mabel? To some of these questions, I hope shortly to be able to provide an answer. No one who knew T.E. Lawrence as I did, scarcely at all, could fail but to be deeply impressed by him. It is given to few men to become, as he did, a legend in his own time. And it was in pursuit of this legend that I sought him out one afternoon in June 1933 at his cottage at Clouds Hill, Dorset. It was a simple cottage, but I thought I detected Lawrence's hand in the rough whitewashed wall, the stout paved doorstep, and the oak door upon which I knocked lightly. It was opened by a small, somewhat unprepossessing figure, slight of frame, fair-haired, with the ruddy, gleaming face of a schoolboy. It was a schoolboy. I had come to the wrong house. I had known of Lawrence, of course, from his exploits in Syria, where he had been attached, though none too deeply, to the British Expeditionary Force. Speaking fluent Sanskrit, he and his Arab servant, an unmade Bedouin of remarkable beauty, had wreaked havoc among the Turkish levies. Shaw, or Ross, as Lawrence now called himself, returned from the East in 1919. Shyness had always been something of a disease with him, and it was this shyness and a certain longing for anonymity that made him disguise himself, clad in the magnificent white silk robes of an Arab prince and wearing in his belt the short curved gold sword of the Ashraf descendants of the Prophet he hoped to pass unnoticed through London. Alas, he was mistaken. Who am I? He would cry despairingly. You are Lawrence of Arabia, passers-by would stop him and say, and I claim my £5.
Sir John Gielgud, in an extract from Alan Bennett's play 40 Years On. And whether or not that helped, we still seem no nearer to defining a modern hero. Perhaps heroism is just imagination in retrospect, and mankind isn't really suited to great deeds. Dr. Johnson.
It is thus that mutual cowardice keeps us in peace. Were one half of mankind brave and one half cowards, the brave would be always beating the cowards. Were all brave, they would lead a very uneasy life. All would be continually fighting. But being all cowards, we go on very well.
Good point there. Perhaps we are all cowards, and perhaps we bring down those who have the seeds of heroism in them. Here's a thought from an anonymous American.
Hail the conquering hero comes, surrounded by a bunch of bums.
We mustn't be too cynical, though. Gallantry, valor, bravery, they still exist. There are still some people who are unafraid of danger and voluntarily undertake hazardous adventures.
Well, welcome to another edition of Adventure. And this week, we are going to take a look at deep sea diving. And here to tell us all about it is Mr. Albert Thomas. And now, Mr. Thomas, I understand that you're a deep sea diver.
No, I'm an insurance salesman.
I beg your pardon?
I'm an insurance salesman.
Oh. Well, I had, as it were, been led to believe that you were, in fact, a deep-sea diver.
No.
I see. Have you ever been a deep-sea diver at any stage of your career?
No.
No. Well, we have just over 2.5 minutes left, so if I may ask you some questions about being an insurance salesman. What is the greatest depth at which you've ever worked?
About 12 feet, sub-basement level.
12 feet. Well, well, well. Now, Mr. Thomas, were you originally attracted to your profession by the romance and adventure traditionally associated with the whole business of selling insurance?
No.
No reason that you should have been. Now, Mr. Thomas, while insuring, do you wear any special apparatus? Like a nose clip or...
No.
Help you with your breathing. Mr. Thomas... While you've been selling insurance, have you ever been attacked by any large fish, like sharks or killer herrings or...
No.
Oh.
I once trod on an orange.
Really? You trod on an orange? Oh, well, well, really? What sort of an orange did you tread on when you trod on it?
Just an ordinary orange.
Well, we were at this stage going to ask you to sing a sea shanty. Do you know any traditional insuring shanties? Any insuring songs that you sing as you go your...
No, we don't have any.
Oh, I seem to have run out of questions. Are there any questions you'd like to ask me about being a BBC interviewer or...
John Cleese, assisted by David Frost. Maybe it's just as well that interview never got underway. It might not have proved very interesting with a real hero. As Ralph Waldo Emerson remarked,
every hero becomes a bore at last.
But on the way to boredom, there are advantages for a hero. For a start, there's the respect of others. Here's a report from a wartime Daily Telegraph.
The popular padre in France is Reverend H. Beecher, M.C. He has a long record as a sportsman. He's also a fine ball games player. I hear that even now, at 62, he's proving that he's as good a rider across the country as ever he was. Father Beecham's prowess and fine character have, I hear, so impressed the members of the officers' mess of a fighter squadron that they gave him their traditional accolade. This consisted of seizing him and holding him upside down.
Another advantage of being a hero is success with women. To the victor belong the spoils, and in Dryden's words...
None but the brave deserves the fair.
Unfortunately, some women don't recognize this fact and don't treat heroes with the respect that is their due. Mr. Alfred Marx will now warm, in fact, melt your heartstrings with a moving ballad entitled Faithless Nellie Gray by the poet Thomas Hood.
Ben Battle was a soldier bold and used to war's alarms, but a cannonball took off his legs, so he laid down his arms. Now, as they bore him off the field, said he, let others shoot, for here I leave my second leg and the 42nd foot. The army surgeons made him limbs, said he, they're only pegs, but there's as wooden members quite as represent my legs. Now, Benny loved a pretty maid, her name was Nelly Gray, so he went to pay her his divorce when he divorced his pay. When he called on Nelly Gray, she made him quite a scoff, and when she saw his wooden legs, began to take them off. Oh, Nelly Gray, is this your love so warm? The love that loves a scarlet coat should be more uniform. She said, I loved a soldier once, for he was blithe and brave, but I will never have a man with both legs in the grave. Before you had those timber toes, your love I did allow, but then you know you stand upon another footing now. Oh, false and fickle Nelly Gray, I know why you refuse. Though I've no feet, some other man is standing in my shoes. I wish I'd never seen your face, but now a long farewell, for you will be my death, alas, you will not be my Nell. So round his melancholy neck a rope he did entwine, and for his second time in life enlisted in the line. One end he tied around a beam and then removed his pegs, and as his legs were off, of course, he soon was off his legs. And there he hung till he was dead as any nail in town, for though distress had cut him up, it could not cut him down. A dozen men set on his corpse to find out why he died, and they buried Ben in four crossroads with a stake in his inside.
After that rather moving moment, let us go up to date to a 20th century hero, a test pilot.
H for Hancock calling control tower. Leveling out at 1,800 miles per hour. Everything going to plan. Fine plane, tell the designer chappy.
Control tower. Control tower to Hancock. We're worried about possible sabotage. The mechanic who was working on your aircraft is missing. Think you should come down. Land immediately. Repeat, land immediately.
Nonsense, she's going beautifully. I don't know a thing about any mechanic. Taking her up to 2,400 miles an hour. Hang off the control tower. Something strange is happening. There's a peculiar knocking sound on the windscreen. Seems to be coming from outside the plane. I'm slowing down to 1,800 miles an hour. We'll slide cockpit open to see what's wrong.
Good evening. It's an awful cold here. You cannot...
What's that?
I say an awful cold here. You cannot come in.
There's no room. Get off.
Oh, don't be like that. Move over, I'll sit on your lap.
Get your boot off me joystick, do you mind? What are you?
Me? I'm the mechanic. I was still working on the tower when you took off. Oh, honestly, frightened the life out of me. I mean, I wasn't expecting it. I was just sitting there singing happily to myself, and then next minute, whoosh, I was up here.
Sit still. I can't control the plane with you jumping about.
Well, I'm only trying to get comfortable. All these knobs and levers here sticking in me. Here, what's this one?
Don't touch it!
Oh, it's the ejector seat. Come back. Where are you?
I'm out here sitting on the tail!
Stop messing about. No, come back in. It's no use sitting out there sulking. I can't drive the thing.
Well, go into a dive so I can slide down.
All right. I'll try this lever. Hello? You might have told me there was another ejection seat.
All right, well, we're both out here. Now what do we do?
Oh, look, we're going up.
Well, what do you expect when we're both sitting on the tail?
Isn't life funny? In the papers this morning, the Star said it was my lucky day.
If we keep going up at this rate, you'll be able to tell them they're wrong.
No, well, come on, we've had a little skylark and a little giggle. Let's go down.
How can we go down? Look, we've finished the engine falling off.
Oh, it's all right. They've got plenty more down there.
We want one up here. We're going into a dive. We're out of control. We can't get back to the cabin. Give me a piece of string.
Oh, I'm scared. Oh,
don't panic, man. Don't panic. This is the RAF. Where's that stiff upper lip?
Just above this loose, slabby chin.
Tony Hancock, Kenneth Williams, and a tiny bit of Hattie Jakes conclude our investigation into heroism. I'm sure heroism still exists. I'm sure we're all capable of it. It's just perhaps that we're all a bit like Tweedledum from Alice Through the Looking Glass.
I'm very brave generally, only today I happen to have a headache.
An heroic farewell from me and from Alfred Marx.
Farewell, a long farewell to all my greatness.
Girls into Heroism was produced by Simon Brett and John Lloyd.